Muy buenas tardes, muchas gracias por su presencia en este evento en el que vamos a hablar sobre un libro maravilloso, El Rey del Azúcar de La Habana, escrito por un periodista inglés, John Paul Rathbone, inglés de educación, pero nacido en Nueva York. Ahora les voy a contar más detalles acerca de este gran periodista, escritor, amigo de Colombia, conocedor de América Latina, amante de Cuba y experto en un personaje extraordinario, Julio Lobo, sobre el cual nos va a contar detalles más adelante. Para efectos de comodidad con la traducción, me han dicho que es preferible que yo hable en inglés, haga las preguntas en inglés y John Paul va a responder en inglés. Él habla muy bien español, pero prefiere hablar en inglés. Entonces, vamos a hacer de aquí en adelante esta conversación en inglés para que ustedes no tengan que estar quitándose y poniéndose los equipos de traducción o bajándole el volumen, etcétera, etcétera. Es más cómodo para todos si lo hacemos en un solo idioma. Entonces, as I was telling you, John Paul Rathbone is a wonderful journalist and writer. He just published this book, The Sugar King of Havana, The Rise and Fall of Julio Lobo, Cuba's Last Tycoon. This is a wonderful story about a character that was a very rich man, very successful speculator in the sugar market, and he was a very creative mind. But before we talk about the book, let me give you some details about John Paul. John Paul was born in New York, son of an Englishman, John Rathbone, and Margarita Sanchez, born in Cuba. John Paul was raised in England. He studied at Oxford University in England and Columbia University in New York. And he's been working for many years as a journalist. He's written many articles for the Wall Street Journal, for the Esquire magazine. He had a column about the business in this wonderful magazine. And since April 2010, he is the editor in charge of Latin America for the Financial Times, which, by the way, is a wonderful newspaper. In my opinion, is the paper that is best covering Latin America, analyzing what's happening in this region. And so congratulations, John Paul, you're doing an excellent job as a journalist. It's not easy to cover Latin America. It's a complex region. It's very difficult to understand, but Financial Times is definitely doing the best reporting about Latin America in the British press. John Paul Rathbone wrote a book, another book, which I discovered through a good common friend, Rurik Ingram, which is a very interesting book as well. This is a travel guide about Ecuador, the Galapagos, and Colombia, written by John Paul 20 years ago. He came here and spent several months traveling in Colombia and in the region. And this is a wonderful book because it's not only a travel guide, typical travel guide, talking about points of interest of where you have to go, etc., etc., but it also has very interesting information about the history, economy, culture, political and social affairs of Colombia. It's a wonderful book, and I hope someday we have the chance to talk about this book you wrote 20 years ago. Okay, so let me tell you, what else can I tell you about John Paul? Let's move ahead and go directly into the Sugar King of Havana. By the way, this book has been praised by the New York Times, and it's doing very well in sales. You can buy it through Amazon. Unfortunately, we don't have a Spanish edition yet, but I hope that will happen sometime soon. This book is wonderful because it's not just a book about Julio Lobo, this fascinating character. This is a book that has many layers, many levels. This is a book about the history of Cuba. This is a book about the history, of course, of Julio Lobo, about the history of the sugar market in the world. And, of course, it's also a book about the history of John Paul's family. And last but not least, very important and very interesting, it has very insightful reflections, remarks, considerations of John Paul about Cuba's history, Cuba's situation, and some ideas about the future of Cuba. It's a very well-written book, of course. It's has tons of research, amazing. 5 years, John Paul spent 5 years doing the research and writing the book, and really this is a wonderful book that I recommend all of you to read. Now let me tell you some basic information about Julio Lobo, and then I will pass it to John Paul. I will ask John Paul to please complete the picture, complete this image, this portrait of this fascinating character, Julio Lobo. Some basic information about Julio Lobo. He was born in Cuba in 1898. This is the year in which Cuba won independence from Spain after a 30-year war. During several decades, Julio Lobo was the king of the sugar market. And this is not just an exaggeration. He really, really dominated the world market. In fact, at a certain point, he was so powerful that he said, like the French kings, he said, "I am the market." He really cornered the market. He really controlled the market. What happened in the market in terms of price, in terms of availability of sugar, that was in his hands, under his control. He was the richest man in Cuba, of course. In today's money, he had a fortune equivalent to $5 billion in today's money. So that gives you an idea of how rich this guy was and how smart he was in speculating in the sugar market and in creating wealth in Cuba. But he also was a philanthropist, and he had a very progressive economic, social, and political view of Cuba and Latin America. And in fact, the workers worked for him, for his companies, for his sugar mills, for his business, they liked him a lot. They admired him, and they felt that he was a person that not only was creating wealth for himself, but for Cuba and for them. This guy was obsessed, a very obsessive collector of Napoleon items. And in fact, he had the largest collection of Napoleon items and documents outside of France, including more than 200,000 documents and 15,000 objects. He was a workaholic, always continually working 24 hours, 7 days, always thinking about his sugar market. He was, however, he had time to for his romantic personal life. He was a womanizer, including famous actress and figures like Bette Davis and Joan Fontaine. And as John Paul says in the book, he inherited from his father his ambition and sense of humor, and from his mother, his very strong temper. Julio Lobo was victim of an attempt to kill him. Maybe John Paul can tell us a little bit more about that. And after Castro came to power, Che Guevara himself offered to Julio Lobo to become the sugar minister in Cuba. He was so important, so smart, that by the way, Julio Lobo had financed the rebels, because he was, as many Cubans, was fed up with Batista, who of course was doing terrible things for Cuba and for the whole population. But Lobo refused to accept this offer, and later the story went bad. His properties were confiscated, expropriated, nationalized, etc., etc. And at the end of his life, Lobo had to go to Spain, where he died almost in poverty, after being one of the richest men in the world, not only in Cuba but in the world. He died in exile and with very little money. So, John Paul, enough of this introduction. Thank you very much for being here. Congratulations for your book. And tell us a little bit more about the book, and please complete the picture of Julio Lobo.
Thank you, Mauricio. Es un placer estar aquí con ustedes, y me da un poco de pena que voy a hacer lo demás del discurso en inglés, but that's the way it is. Sorry, folks. Mauricio, usually I interview Mauricio, now he's questioning me, so like all good diplomats, you've managed to turn the tables. I just wanted to explain, I wrote this book, guidebook to Colombia 20 years ago, and the reason why it goes Ecuador, Galapagos, and Colombia in third place is because I wrote it in 1989, very bad year to write a guidebook to Colombia, and so my publishers took Colombia from the front, and they put it at the bottom. So that's why Colombia comes after the Galapagos Islands, which must have a millionth of the size of the Colombian economy. Anyway, Julio Lobo, what attracted me to Julio Lobo was one very personal reasons. I grew up in England, and as still today, Cuba still generates a lot of cariño. Last night, almost, the Buena Vista Social Club and people in Cartagena were saying, Viva Cuba. And this was a band who's only has two original members left, the rest having died. So literally, Viva Cuba has a certain poignancy. And I grew up in England where everyone actually was rather sympathetic towards Cuba. And I could never quite reconcile their views about Cuba with the stories that I heard, and both from the island and outside the island. So I grew up with a sense of contradiction and paradox that I wanted to resolve all my life. And Julio Lobo was a great vehicle to expose these contradictions because, A, he was a universal figure. He was extremely cosmopolitan and sophisticated and robust. And his life story began in 1898, the year of Cuban independence, more or less, and ended in 1960, at least his experience in Cuba, when he was exiled from the island. So he was a vehicle to tell the story of the Cuban pre-revolutionary republic, which is a very underexplored area. If you go to a library, at least in England, and maybe it's the same in Colombia, it's certainly true in the United States, you go to a Latin American library, you see the Argentine shelves. Maybe there's one row there. You go to the Brazilian shelves, there are maybe two rows of Brazilian books. Go to Colombia, again, there might be one row. They go to the Cuban, there's like five rows of books. There's just endless books written about Cuba. But most of them are about after the revolution. And the number of books that are devoted to the pre-revolutionary period are very, very small. And it seemed to me that if you could get a better sense of what Cuba was like before the revolution, maybe you would get a better sense of what Cuba might become after the revolution. And Lobo was one. He was a sort of narrative vehicle to tell the story. And also, his life was so paradoxical and contradictory. To be an emblem of capitalism, to have wealth, to be a millionaire in an era when there were very few millionaires in the world, and to be one of the world's most talented speculators, always a derided figure, and yet to be recognized as so talented at his job that Che Guevara actually asked him to become sugar minister, those kinds of ideas turn your preconceptions about what Cuba may have been like before the revolution on their head. And it's not just that example. All through his life, he shows that Cuba wasn't quite the way it's often been depicted, either by those who are sympathetic to Cuba and the revolution outside the island, and of course the government inside the island, who have tried to whitewash, for obvious and understandable reasons, the past. How can you also resist a man who has a terrific sense of humor? The day after he met with Che Guevara, he returned to his office to pick up his affairs, and he went into his office, and there was a boy, one of the militia, dressed in army fatigues at his desk with his feet on the table, smoking a cigar, and he said, "Ah, Mr. Lobo, we have you exactly where we want you, stripped of everything, almost naked." And Lobo shot back and said, "Chico, I was born naked, I will die naked, and some of my best moments in my life have been when I was naked." And this is a man who's just lost all his wealth, and he has the presence of mind to come up with a quip like that as extraordinary character. And it's important that he was a universal figure in the sense that although he was based in Havana and he loved Havana, he was a man who spoke at least four languages fluently. He traveled widely. He was a cosmopolitan in a sense that you would recognize today as cosmopolitan. And he had friends all over the world. And I think that his universality, I think, speaks to certain universal Cuban themes. And because I believe that one reason why people have this bizarre fascination with the island is it has a certain universality to it, as perhaps as an emblem of romantic hope, but also as a projection of people's ideas of what a revolutionary tropical republic can be. As Jean-Paul Sartre said when he first arrived in Havana after the revolution, "For the first time in my life, I have seen happiness attained by violence," which is such a bizarre idea, and yet it's captivated a lot of people's imagination. And Julio Lobo, through the concreteness of his life, as well as just his own life being a narrative motor with lots of action and drama, but he punctures these bloated and highfalutin ideas and brings everything down to earth. So that was just those are some of the reasons why I was drawn to Julio Lobo.
John Paul, how did your book, after 5 years of research and writing, change your views about Cuba and about Julio Lobo? What changed?
I suppose the image that comes to my mind is when you fly over the Amazon, you see all these treetops, and you see the leaves, and they look like broccoli, and you know there are trees underneath that are supporting them. And in the same way, I had a view of where Cuba was today, and I was just curious to try and understand better the shapes of the structures underneath that explained how Cuba had come to become what it is, the glory and the hopes that were embodied in the revolution, and then also the despair and the disillusionment that has followed afterwards, and the symbol of hopes that it became. So I came to understand more the historical roots of the revolution, which go back from today, about 130 years. And Fidel Castro didn't just come out of the situation of Batista. He came out of a much longer tradition. Basically, the Cubans have been fighting for some kind of independence or sense of selfhood since 1868. And it's been a very bloody fight as well. The concentration camp was invented not in South Africa, as some English think. In fact, it was invented in Cuba when General Weyler was sent out by the Spanish to gather Cubans in concentration camps. And this was in 1870. So just to give you a sense of the violence and the bloodiness that has marbled all of Cuban history. So that was another thing that struck me. And a lot of the book actually is a plea for a more sort of liberal, in the English sense, liberal view of Cuban history and of Cuban possibilities.
Your book is a huge jigsaw puzzle with many, many pieces. It's amazing. It's full of information, detailed information, very interesting information that really adds value to the whole history, not only of Lobo and Cuba and the Rathbones family, but it also helps you navigate through the book in a very interesting and entertaining way. But I wonder, how did you design this book? How did you build this book? It must have been a nightmare to create the whole picture and then the individual pieces and put them all together to finally get a book which is full of details, but at the same time does not lose you in minutiae and does not overwhelm you with data and information which is not relevant. How was the process of writing the book?
Yeah, well, I can't say it was all enjoyable, and there were definitely moments when I wanted to pick up a piece of a passage and sort of smash it on the table and because I have to rearrange all the pieces. But I didn't have an intellectual epiphany about when I was coming towards the book. I had a sort of a sense of an emotional imprint that I wanted to leave the book to read, because it is about nostalgia and it's about loss and it's about death and it's also about happier things like bewitchment and enchantment. And so I wanted to leave these kinds of impressions. And there was a moment, one afternoon, when I had a vague idea of a structure. And actually, later on, it was amazing how close I stuck to that structure. But there are three narratives, which is the main narrative of Julio Lobo, the narrative of my mother's family and their dealings, sometimes with extraordinary characters like José Martí, and then also my own personal narrative, which is sotto voce, because I don't want to presume to be a player in this book, but I think it helps the reader to have a little bit of first-person narrative, a little bit of actualité. So when it works, I felt great. It was a high to have figured out how to entwine these three narratives together, and then when it didn't work, it was a nightmare. The detail is, again, because I wanted this to be a book that could puncture myths, a lot of it is based on, it's all based on concrete detail, and that's what motors a fast-paced book is active verbs and concrete detail, telling little details. There's one of my favorite details is that the sugar mill that Julio Lobo bought, that was his downfall, really, in the end, his Waterloo, this is a man who thought in Napoleonic ways, was a sugar mill called Hershey, which was founded by Milton Hershey, the Ammonite United States sugar chocolate maker. And what's striking about Milton Hershey is he bought his sugar mill in Cuba in the 1920s, thereabouts, and he was very in love with his wife. And when his wife, Kitty, died, he retired to his sugar mill in Cuba. And this was an old man, very melancholy, towards the end of his years, 1920s, the roaring 20s. And he would spend his days in his study scraping the liver spots off the back of his hand with a penknife and then moistening them with cocoa butter. And it's just so melancholy, such a melancholy image. And then 30 years later, Julio Lobo buys the sugar mill, and it's a moment actually of hope and looking forward, misplaced hope in the end. So that's, I tried to build the scene and the narrative always through concrete details and the actions of specific men and exactly what they did. Again, puncturing the sort of highfalutin languages that often surrounds Cuba.
What kind of reactions have you gotten from your book, positive, negative, in Cuba, outside of Cuba, people in favor of Castro, against Castro? What has been the reaction? Not the reviews from the experts, but the reaction of the common reader.
Well, one reaction that I was very pleased about is it got a write-up in Juventud Rebelde, which is the Cuban paper, and I thought, I was amazed when I saw it on the internet that the main book reviewer had reviewed the book in Cuba. This is obviously what I would like to happen, but what struck me is the way that he reviewed it. You could tell that this was a man who was writing and measuring every single word extremely carefully, and there were no judgments in his description of the book, which was a pure description. He didn't say it was good or it was bad. He just said, this is what happened. So I thought that was very telling. He was trying to tell the story, but within the sort of very narrow space that's available within censorship. Amongst others, it's a bit like a fruitcake, this book. Some people like the nuts, some people like the raisins, and some people like the sixpences if they find them. But mostly, Cuba is sort of a meditative stone, and people see in it what they want to see in it. So one person will read the book and reach a completely different conclusion from another person who read the book, because they're so attached to some idea that, or meaning that they attach to Cuba. Even though I try to do my best and steer them in a particular way, I leave it to the author to make up, the reader to make up their own mind.
Let me read the last paragraph of the book, The Sugar King of Havana. It says, Lobo made Cuba not only wealthy, but more Cuban. So let there be more Lobos, as Tinguaros workers once declared. Tinguaro was the name of the hacienda of Julio Lobo, his preferred place in Cuba. So I repeat, Lobo made Cuba not only wealthy, but more Cuban. So let there be more Lobos, as Tinguaro's workers once declared. The king is dead. Long live the king. And Cuba's future queens, emperors, empresses, princesas, distinguidos, and caballeros too. That's the closing paragraph of the book. And it suggests a future in which there might be opportunities for other Julio Lobos. and for other creators of wealth and entrepreneurs and princesas, emperadores, empresses, etc., etc. Is that future near? What is it going to happen? How is it going to happen? What's your view on the following years for Cuba?
People often ask me, they say, okay, you've written a book about Julio Lobo and a book about Cuba, so what's going to happen next? And people have been asking that question for 50 years. And there are certain things that won't change. And one of them is that Cuba will remain an island, relatively large, it's the size of England and Wales, that remains 90 miles off the coast of the United States. As Cabrera Infante, the Cuban novelist, said about Castro, history will absolve him, but never geography. So that's an unalterable fact. Its biggest market, its natural market, the United States will remain there. What else will remain the same? I argue here that Cubans have an innate entrepreneurial spirit. Why? Because they've always been involved in the sugar industry. And it was an international, it was the first internationally traded commodity that existed, really, on such a scale. And since the 18th century, Cuba has been exposed to globalization in a way that many other countries only just are now. And that lent them a sophistication and an openness to the world. In that sense, Cuba is rather like England, which actually is how I reconciled myself through this book. They're small islands off the coast of small land masses. They tend to dominate those large land masses. England has had a disproportionate influence on Europe. Cuba has had a disproportionate influence on the United States and actually on Latin America around it. And you can think of other examples. Japan has had another example, disproportionate influence on Asia. So islands are weird places, and they have very powerful characters, but characteristics. But one of them, I argue here, is this Cuban talent for entrepreneurship and speculation. The irony that the so-called Jews of the Caribbean have been in a system of 50 years of socialism, sort of tried to grind that entrepreneurial spirit into the dust, which I don't think has happened. One thing that's very interesting, I think, is now that, in some senses, the transition has already begun. Fidel Castro is no longer around. There's very little talk of communism anymore. It's all about national values and Martí.
And Raúl Castro is talking about reforms.
Raúl Castro is talking about economic reforms and
giving the possibility of the workers that have been working for the government to now create their own companies because they cannot afford to continue paying them salaries because public finances are in deep trouble and they need to create wealth and the employment and income for the government.
Well, it's extraordinary when you consider the ambitiousness of the reforms because they're going to sack nearly 2 million workers, which is one in five Cubans, as of the end of next year, will have lost their jobs, and they're supposed to go and create their own employment elsewhere. And where will they get credit from? Answer, perhaps the exiles. And I was in Havana last year, and I went to Julio Lobo's old office, and you'd have thought this would be a man who'd be disparaged by the revolution, but no, someone had mounted a plaque on the wall recently, honoring the memory of Julio Lobo, that talked about his ability to create wealth, and it was very straightforward, unideological. So there is this new idea of perhaps that, you know, releasing some of this entrepreneurial energy, which Cubans have in abundance. I mean, a lot of Cubans have done well in the United States, and that's also true of Mexico. I'm sure it's also true of Colombia. So what I would say is that I don't think there's going to be a before and after moment, a Berlin Wall moment in Cuba, because in some senses it's already happened. The transition is already underway. And so when people say what's going to happen after, I say look at the island, because it's already happening now. And as to the idea of Cuba as a victim to Yankee imperialism, there's a very strong element of truth to that. And U.S. policy towards the island has been a sort of David versus Goliath relationship, with the states obviously being Goliath, which has... those kinds of bully boy tactics have won Cuba a lot of sympathy around the world. But Cuba is not a victim. And you see that in Julio Lobo's story. You also see that in Cuba's success in Africa. They had three military campaigns in the second half of the 20th century. And perhaps when you think of what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, no other country has had similar military success in Africa since the Second World War. So this is not a country that is a victim. It's a country that's actually been more in charge of its destiny than is often presumed. And I think that's a very important part of the revolutionary narrative that has to be questioned.
Okay, we're halfway through this conversation, and we had promised you we were going to talk about this wonderful book, The Sugar King of Havana, but also we want to discuss with John Paul Rathbone his views about Latin America. Being John Paul, the editor for Latin America for the Financial Times, he's an expert in our region, if we can find an expert in Latin America, which is always a very complex task. My first question related to Latin America and your views as a journalist is, and this comes from one of your columns I read recently, does Latin America really exist? Is Latin America a homogeneous region, and you can talk about Latin America, or there are different Latin Americans within this geography? How do you see Latin America as an entity?
Well, I definitely want to preface anything I say by the fact that I'm mostly in London, although I travel a lot to Latin America, and I enjoy, it's an extraordinary job that I can travel to so many different places, and I have enjoy great access. But this is a view of someone who's trying to explain Latin America to people who don't understand or know very much about Latin America, although I hope what I say also has interest to Latin Americans. And it's definitely noteworthy that Brazil, which is what has basically put Latin America back on the map, and I'm thinking of the map of people in Europe or in Asia rather than the United States, which is a different relationship. It's Brazil that's responsible really for lifting the image of Latin America. And Brazil doesn't consider itself part of Latin America. It doesn't really doesn't understand the idea of Latin America. They consider Latin America, and actually there's quite, Itamari, the foreign ministry there, has, I think, devoted quite a lot of research into pointing actually where the coin Latin America was made, and I think it was in Peru. So the idea of Latin America has always been a shaky one, especially as a lot of people in the region don't even speak a Latin language. They speak an indigenous language like Quechua, Guarani. Nonetheless, it's a useful conceptual construct from afar. And just going back to the book for a moment, you know, in the book I try to pin down on the details, try to get really down into, under the skin of a character in a country in a way that, of course, that journalism can't. One, in journalism, you can offer a broad sweeping overview. You can offer the mountaintops, if not the valleys. But really to understand Latin America and the solutions to some of the problems it faces, you really have to get into the nitty-gritty, into the micro. I don't think I really answered your question there.
So how do you see Latin America? Some analysts believe that Latin America has three or four different realities. One, Brazil is a separate continent, almost, as you mentioned. But then you find a very modern Latin America tending to be more conservative, oriented to the right ideologically. You have a moderate center to left, and then you have a radical left in terms of political identities. And those are the three or four Latin Americas. Would you agree with that kind of description of Latin America?
When you talk of different Latin Americas, I tend to think of, say, the modernity of Bogota or the modernity of Cartagena. Here we are speaking English to an audience, many of whom are bilingual. And then a few hundred miles away, in the peak of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, you have a pre-Columbian group that have maintained their priestly class and almost unique. So for me, are the multiple Latin Americas, the different sort of periods of history in which the continent lives. One of the lessons from Brazil, I think, is that you can be popular, which Lula was, without necessarily being populist. And I think that's an important lesson, this sort of the social democrat model, if you like, that Bachelet represented in Chile. There was a fascinating poll I saw the other day that tracked Latin Americans' opinions of how they saw themselves on the political spectrum. It went back about 10 years, and one was extreme right, and 10 was extreme left. And more or less, the Latin American average is 4.5, so just a little bit left of center. But if you go back 2 years, it was 4.3. And if you go back a few years before that, it was like 4.7. So Latin America, if you ask people how they see themselves on average, it seems to be a very kind of pragmatic center-left. And the idea that had so much currency 10 years ago about how Latin America was moving to the left, in fact, has proved to be a chimera.
Recently, there has been a lot of talk about this decade being the decade of Latin America, that finally Latin America is going to take off in Latin America's potential is going to be unleashed, and that this is the time to invest in Latin America, and that Latin America's future has never been as bright as now. Do you agree with that view, or are you also optimistic?
I'd like to be optimistic, because that's how I managed to sell more stories into the newspaper, because there's competition for space in the newspaper. I have to compete with stories from Asia, Europe, the United Kingdom, the United States. And everyone prefers a good story, actually, notwithstanding what people think about journalists. Latin America has been very lucky over the past 10 years in the sense that it's ridden this incredible commodity boom, which in turn is due to Asia. But it's not just luck. As they say, luck knocks on the door to see if prudence is in. And when luck knocked on the door in Latin America, in many cases, prudence had been there. Sometimes I like to think how 20 years ago, with the Latin American debt crisis, if you told the room of Latin Americans, you know, in just 2 decades, your economies are going to be in better shape than the United States and Western Europe, everyone would have fallen off their chairs laughing. And yet, lo and behold, 20 years later, that is more or less the situation where we are now. I mean, you can't call Latin America, any Latin American economy, a developed economy. But, you know, the degree of progress has been, in very many cases, Brazil, Colombia, Peru, Chile, Mexico, has been extraordinary. So, do I think it can last? One of the answers lies in Asia, what happens in Asia and China, and also the responses of Latin American governments and how they continue to take forward what it's established, what's been established so far. Let's just take the serious countries. I think you know what I mean by the serious countries as opposed to the unserious ones, some of your neighbors. But they've established macroeconomic stability. But what remains to be done is the second generation of reforms and social stability, I think.
Reforms as what? What would you recommend? What would you suggest? What kind of reforms? Social reforms, macroeconomic reforms, institutional reforms? Which are the priorities for Latin America to really take off?
Well, to achieve macroeconomic stability involves many different things, you know, fiscal responsibility and perhaps central bank independence, de jure or de facto, some structural reforms. It's a whole panoply of things that have been put in place over the past 10 years. But the next step is to achieve social stability. And, I mean, the target there is to reduce, surely, violence and crime and criminality, which is the highest in the world outside any countries that are at war. Now, I'm not saying, you know, this is, you generalize from the averages and say, well, there's lots of killings in Mexico, ergo, if you go to Mexico, you're going to get shot. No, because if you go to Mexico, just like if you go to Colombia, there are certain areas that are very violent and others where you haven't a clue that nothing is happening. But so to offer citizens a level of social stability where they can lead their lives without fear. And social stability also includes access to education and health. How you achieve those things is another matter, but I think that's the next objective for the continent.
Oscar Guardiola is a Colombian writer and scholar that lives in London, and he wrote recently a wonderful book that has a very attractive title. The title is What If Latin America Ruled the World? What's your answer to that title?
Well, it's a kind of brilliant book in many ways. I wouldn't call it a wonderful book because I found it a rompecabezas. It's a great title, but I don't think he ever answers the question.
That's why I'm asking you for the answer.
If Latin America ruled the world, well, I think if more of the world, say, were to be like Latin America, I mean, there would be some unambiguous good things. I have a friend who runs a travel agency in Lima, and she's inviting Asians who like to come to Latin America because they see here nature that doesn't exist in Asia anymore. The ecological bounty that still exists in Latin America is without peer, even probably more than in Africa, the virgin beauty. So sort of a regard for the environment and keeping the environment and what you have, obviously it's a resource that has to be managed. But managing it is one thing. And then I think, I mean, personally, the role of the family that exists in Latin America.
The social network of support is very important, not only for the well-being of people, but for the economy as well, and for the democracy. The strength of families in Latin America is definitely a unique asset of our region, which we can export to other regions in the world.
I don't know if you can export it, but as an idea, it's very attractive.
It's an idea to export.
It has its flip side. My Cuban grandfather, used to say the difference between the Anglo-Saxons and the Latins was that the Latins had a sense of family and no sense of society, and the Anglo-Saxons had no sense of family but a great sense of society. Obviously, a generalization and, you know, massive exceptions to the rule, but he had something there. And really, you need both. But in terms of the support network that a family can offer, when you think of Spain, where there's 20% unemployment, I mean, the place would be up in smoke if it weren't for the fact that so many Spaniards are living with their families. There'll still be a lost generation, and it's very sad what's happening in Spain. But without the family networks, I think it would probably be even worse.
Jean-Paul, in one of your recent articles at the Financial Times, you wrote that Latin America still has lots of poor people, but what now defines the region is its growing middle class. Please elaborate.
Okay, so
this concept.
This is a statement really that's not really for Latin American consumption. It's for foreign consumption, because it's the idea that Latin America is a land of a man with a mustache, a guitar, and a revolver, as Gabriel García said. And this is a very strong, you know, image and prejudice, if you like, or stereotype of a region. But it's changing. When I came to Colombia in 1989 and wrote this guidebook, that was the image of Colombia, a man with a mustache and a guitar and a revolver. But it's more subtle and marbled now, and that's true of Latin America as well. And one thing that has changed it is the realization that not everyone, you know, is a poor person. Not everyone is either very poor or very rich. There is this important middle class that's growing. 30 million Brazilians lifted out of poverty in 10 years is a really remarkable achievement, whether you agree with Mr. Lula or not. And he has a certain megalomaniacal streaks in him that are, you know, definitely not the most attractive. But still, it's a remarkable achievement. And it's not only true of Brazil as well, either.
Now that you mention García Márquez, our Nobel Prize winner, he wrote something about Latin America that says as follows: Latin America is the leading creative force in the world, and that creativity is the most needed raw material in the planet. Do you agree with this statement, or is this just a nice and, I don't know, wishful thinking?
Well, if you measure it by the amount of patents, say, that are generated in Latin America, then it's definitely wrong, because Latin America registers very few new patents for new inventions compared, say, to Asia. But I think he means a different kind of creativity, and I think he's talking more about a spiritual creativity, perhaps. This is me interpreting what he says. So I'd like to think that.
I read recently an interesting comment about the difference between creativity and innovation. Latin Americans, we tend to be very creative, but we are not as innovative. What's the difference? The difference is that being creative is to have the idea, and we have plenty of ideas. But an innovation is converting the idea into reality. And that's where we have trouble, in the whole process of having a creative idea becoming a reality. In that sense, there are many other societies, other places in the world that are more disciplined, better organized, and follow through and get things accomplished. And probably that's one of the reasons why being creative is not enough. You need to do more things to really have economic, social, political progress.
Well, what is it? It's 1%, Bernard Shaw said it's 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration, and maybe Latin America needs a little bit more perspiration.
Yeah, absolutely. How do you see the relation of Latin America with the U.S., with several other regions of the world, with the U.S., with the European Union, and which should be our strategy towards China and India, the new world superpowers? So let's go by countries, with the U.S.
United States. Well, Colombia,
Latin America. Latin America in particular, if you want, but also the whole region.
Well, what has struck me is writing about Latin America today, as opposed to, say, 10 years ago, which was the last time when I was similarly engaged in Latin America, is how less important what the United States thinks about Latin America is. So Latin America, in a way, is sort of disassociating itself. Obviously not Mexico, because that's almost, it's almost part of the United States because of NAFTA, in the same way that Canada is. But
and that's good or bad, in your opinion?
Well, so far from God, so near to the United States. I mean, it's Mexico's, that's its destiny to be next to the United States.
The rest of Latin America being more dissociated from the U.S., less dependent, less influenced by the U.S., you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
It's all part of this sort of multipolar world that's happening. I wonder sometimes if, you know, you think of Latin America, you think of it as being traditionally Catholic, and you think of it, and there's a rise and rise of the evangelical movement, and you think of Latin America as being looking to Europe and having commercial ties with the United States and increasing its looking to Asia. I do idly speculate, I wonder if this goes on, say, for decades and decades, it might be a very, very different Latin America in 50 years if the Asian influence becomes stronger and the Catholic element weakens. That would shift culture in very profound and important ways. Is it good? It seems to be inevitable and happening anyway. I don't know how much choice Latin America has. And I'm not saying it doesn't have a choice over its destiny, but it has certain factors that it's endowed with, especially in commodity wealth, and exports those commodities, which is not necessarily a bad place to be. It just depends on how you manage it. And the demand for those is in Asia, and inevitably that brings closer contact with Asia.
What about the relation between Latin America and the European Union? Is that getting closer, better? Are there plenty of opportunities for both regions to benefit from a closer relation?
I'm sure you've got a better idea than I do, as promoting Colombia in Europe. But I hope the European Latin American ties remain as strong. I didn't fully realize when I was in London that in fact Sao Paulo is the same distance from London as it is from New York. So, you know, I mentioned that just as one example, that Sao Paulo, Brazil, you know, it's as close to Europe as the United States, and it's closer to Africa, and the whole South trade is becoming more and more important. So, for Brazil, which has got the largest black population in the world, other than Nigeria, you know, to have African relationships is obviously fundamental.
Let's talk about a very controversial issue that has been discussed recently a lot in the British press and the Latin American press in the U.S., which is the subject of legalization of drugs, or at least decriminalization of drugs. What's your personal view on this very complex issue?
I was in a room of Mexicans the other day over dinner, and they were complaining about the drugs war. And having been here in 1989, what really struck me is how I felt like I was watching Colombia 2. It was the same arguments, the same preoccupations, the same angers, the same frustrations as I had witnessed in Colombia 20 years before. And again, the subject of legalization came up, which is a very interesting debate. It's worth making a point about that. Just in Mexico, it's a very interesting debate, but it's a debate that's going to go on for a long time. And in the meantime, countries have to act. And I think that, so Calderon, although maybe the way in which it's happened is not the best, I think it's correct that, you know, you have to try and fight the narcos to make life manageable for average citizens. As to legalization or decriminalization, legalization, you have to recognize that there's a spectrum of drugs. You know, marijuana is not cocaine, cocaine is not bazooka, and bazooka is not crystal meth. And crystal meth is particularly interesting because it's a synthetic drug, just like ecstasy or MDMA, which can be manufactured in New York or Brussels. It doesn't have to be from a particular country where, say, a coca leaf is produced or a marijuana plant. And also, you know, marijuana, maybe, you know, someone high on marijuana might be more likely to have a car crash, but it may not be necessarily bad for his or her health. It's a question of performance, but someone who is taking or smoking bazooka or taking crystal meth, that is an active substance that is actively disintegrating the body. So you have to recognize, I think, that there's a spectrum of drugs before one can talk sensibly about decriminalizing. You have to talk about decriminalizing or legalizing what. it seems to me.
You agree with the proposal of some former presidents of Latin America, joined now by scientists and journalists all over the world, that there should be a debate about the approach to drugs, because the war on drugs is not producing positive results. Just let me give you an example. In Colombia, we have reduced the coca crops by 38% in the last 10 years. And in the meantime, in that same lapse of time, consumption of cocaine has doubled in Europe. So it's very frustrating. We make a lot of efforts, a lot of sacrifices, lots of lives lost, billions of dollars spent in this war, and the consumption is just increasing and increasing and increasing, and we pay a very high price for that. It's very frustrating. So we should have a discussion on new formulas. I don't know. I don't have an exact response, but I would like scientists and experts discuss alternatives, because what we've seen is not positive.
I mean, the economic case for legalizing drugs is impeccable. Legalized drugs get responsible companies to produce it, tax the hell out of them, use those taxes to then fund care for those people who can't manage the drugs. But there is perhaps a moral dimension, and that's the bit that needs probably to be discussed, and also how you manage it. What struck me as painfully ironic is that in Europe, one of the arguments about why legalizing drugs was a good idea started to gain some traction was when people saw that, in fact, the cultivation of drugs had ecological consequences. So it was the idea that the poor old Amazon was being deforested.
Sniffing the rainforest. We show a wonderful documentary in Europe and in the U.S. produced by former Vice President Pacho Santos, in which we show the connection of people sniffing cocaine and how this destroys the environment. The Colombian rainforests, for example, and the reaction has been very positive to that. People really feel that it's terrible that cocaine consumption and production is affecting so negatively the environment. So that's a creative way of sending the message. But at the same time, at the end of the day, consumption still continues rising.
That is an imaginative way of internationalizing and universalizing what is a universal problem where producing countries are bearing the brunt of the fight. I'm sure the tide is, I have a sense also in the United States the tide is turning, because it has the problem right there on its doorstep with Mexico, and its involvement in what makes the situation in Mexico so awful at the moment is very clear. The sale of high caliber machine gun weapons, 80% of the weapons that the narcos use in Mexico come from the United States. The response from the United States is, it's part of our constitutional arrangement. You know, you can never decriminalize it. But yet at the same time, you know, they expect constitutional change in Mexico to take place, such as unifying the police force to meet the similar challenge. So at some point, there has to be a meeting. And in the meantime, the United States is spending billions and billions of dollars. Its jails are filling up with millions of minor offenders. I mean, United States, U.S. jails are filled with convicts, but most of them are in there for very, very minor offenses. They shouldn't be in there. They should be doing something different. And then you get onto the idea of prison reform as well, which I think is extremely important, not only in the United States, but also here. And Ruben Blades said something very interesting the other night, is how can you reintegrate, you know, prisons as opposed to places where you reintegrate people back into society, or at least should have some notional idea of that. But how can you reintegrate people into society who have never been integrated in the first place? Which returns again to the whole social question in Latin America. I've taken it back to the Latin American example, but it's also true of the consumers in the United States and Europe.
In this last 5 minutes, let's talk about the future of Colombia. Hmm. How do you see Colombia? Which are, in your opinion, our strengths, our weaknesses? How much progress have you seen in Colombia in the past 20 years that you've followed Colombia closely? What else do we have to do, or what do we have to do differently? Are you optimistic about Colombia? You have some caveats? You're worried? What's your view on the future of Colombia?
I mean, this is highly sensitive to talk about this in Colombia with Colombians who know much, much better than I do. I'll be the first to admit that, and especially because these solutions, as I was talking about earlier, you know, you need micro understandings. But since 20 years ago, when I talk about Colombia in London or the United States, drugs and guerrillas are not the first thing that comes to everyone's mind necessarily. There's also Shakira. I'm not saying that's necessarily the only thing that comes to mind, but also the sense that Colombia is progressing and the economy is growing. It's a responsible place. I think the constitutional ruling forbade President Uribe for running for a third time was extremely important, as was the fact that he obeyed it. It showed that Colombia, had a legal process. This country, which has got extreme legalism and extreme lawlessness, here the legalism was winning out. And I think it was an important, obviously not just for Colombia, but for its projection abroad, it sort of de-tropicalized the tropics, in my mind anyway. Not everyone agrees with me. Especially, interestingly, not a lot of Colombians don't agree with me. I take a less dim view. But it de-exoticized the tropics. And given some of your neighbors, Cuba to the north, Venezuela to the east, I think that's good. It shows Colombia is a serious place.
And how about the economy? Do you see the potential? Do you see the opportunities for investment here? Are we able to compete with Chile or Brazil or Mexico in attracting foreign investment? How do you see Colombia in the world competitiveness scenario?
Well, Colombian competitiveness seems to be getting better. And I expect it's probably, in fact, I know it's much easier to set up a business here in Colombia than it is to set up a business in Brazil. But Colombia is a smaller market than Brazil. Nonetheless, that doesn't stop Procter & Gamble's or Asian companies from coming here too. And if you're the CEO of a large, say, European company with $1 billion to invest next year, do you think, well, am I going to invest in the United States? Yeah, it's growing okay. Recovery, free markets are pretty well established there. That's a possibility. You look at Europe and you think, not so sure about that. I mean, Spain could default. And then you think about Asia, China, and Latin America, and you think, well, how am I going to share out my money between those places? But that's where the growth is. So obviously fashions change, and trends sustain themselves for however long they sustain themselves. But I think there's lots of reasons to be optimistic here.
Okay. Good. Well, on this positive note, we conclude this conversation with John Paul Rathbone. Thanks for coming to Cartagena, John Paul, and congratulations for your book and for this conversation.